Our firm is located right in the downtown heart of Goderich, Ontario, right on what is called the square, but visitors to the town would say, no, that's not a square, it's more like a hexagon. It's a circle with a courthouse in the center and all of the businesses and buildings situated around it.
Well, the square in town is sort of the hub of Goderich, really. Like, everything happens there. There's really great local shops, and you just have access to anything you need, right? So groceries, there's a butcher on the square, restaurants, and there's live music on the square. Yeah, it just is sort of the hub of the town.
It was a hot summer afternoon in Goderich, Ontario. People were enjoying a day at the beach or taking in the sun with neighbors or friends at home. But August 21st, 2011, was not like any other day.
At first, it was just total disbelief. And then next thoughts immediately went to people's various family members who lived in Goderich and who were elderly and who were vulnerable. And we went in and attended the actual ceremony of the wedding, and then we left and drove back to Goderich. And by the time we got here, the place was in darkness. Of course, there's no light. And it was deathly silent because none of the work of chainsaws had started. And it was eerie. Everything was all over the place. All the power lines were down. The roads were completely impassable. And people were just walking around in silence. They were in terrible shock.
At 3:55 p.m., an F3 tornado roared through the town's breakwall at 300 kilometers an hour, ramming into the coast and going straight through the square, the heart of Goderich.
So it formed on the other side of the lake. It came across the lake and it picked up its momentum when it hit the land, which is again unusual. And it passed through the town in about 13 seconds. It did the damage. The Insurance Bureau of Canada estimated somewhere around $250 million worth of damage to properties. That's probably an underestimate by the time it was completed. But there was private sector damage and there was public sector damage.
The overwhelming feeling for me was just a sense of complete shock and chaos. And the funny thing is, when you enter into a zone that's been hit by a tornado, you're looking at something that you don't recognize. So the building has become so different from what it was that you're a little bit off center. You're very dizzy because your eyes are focusing on something and you can't relate to what it is.
Power poles and trees were snapped and uprooted. The historic buildings surrounding the square had their windows blown, roofs torn off, or upper floors completely destroyed. Vehicles in the square were overturned and impaled by flying debris, and power lines were everywhere. Despite the 37 people injured, and one person fatally injured, it could have been worse.
The other thing that was so amazing about this is that where you're sitting, you can see the square, the courthouse square, and there used to be a flea market on the square every Sunday from 12 until 4 o'clock. And the tornado hit shortly after 4 p.m. on that Sunday afternoon. Interestingly enough, because there'd been a bit of nasty weather and some rain, all of the flea market people had packed up and gone home. Otherwise, the injury would have been, I can't begin to say what the injury or the injury toll or even death toll might have been.
3 days after the tornado hit, the forecast called for torrential rain. With most of their roofs gone, business owners and residents on the square scrambled to salvage what they could. Heather Ross of the Ross Law Firm was one of them.
We came in here and literally at times were crawling around on our bellies so as not to be spotted by the civil authority outside, covering up phones and computers and bagging everything up and covering desks and draping rolls of plastic all over the place. That was Tuesday. And then Wednesday we came in to find the devastation that the rain had caused.
Susanna Reed is a registered professional planner at Huron County. She uses something called the Panarchy Model to help give context to the tornado. It's a framework associated with ecological systems that she thinks can help people understand how communities and places change and how we can use design to steer that change.
So this framework has four components. First would be the exploitation phase, followed by a conservation phase, and then a release, some sort of creative destruction, and then a reorganization phase. So in applying this to an ecological system like a forest, the exploitation phase would be a growth phase. So would see a forest move from a meadow to a mature forest. And then something would happen like a forest fire that would be a release of energy and enter that system into creative destruction or release. And there is the system doesn't have any option but to reorganize itself.
This framework can be applied to the Goderich story.
The exploitation phase or the growth phase would look sort of like business as usual. So it tends to unfold over a long period of time. So Goderich, as it's occurred, you know, over, I don't know, the last 20 or 30 years, perhaps the downtown core was struggling a little bit, but in general, it was sort of status quo. And when the tornado happened, that would have represented a creative destruction. So a crisis point where energy was released. And from the perspective of the downtown core and the design that it represented, it would have been the release phase where the community had an opportunity to reorganize and redesign the downtown core. In fact, they had no choice because, you know, the buildings were destroyed.
But this reorganization is a dynamic process and doesn't happen in a straight line.
I would say that building resilience, or this expression, anti-fragility, inviting communities to become stronger than they were, is a creative exercise, and it's dynamic, and it unfolds if you give people an opportunity to engage in their own potential and the sense of potential of the place that they love.
Susan Armstrong is head of the Goderich Business Improvement Area.
George Dark was here. I was really lucky. He came and spoke at our AGM, the year of the tornado, and he had a great comment. He said, if you do things the way you've always done things, if you rebuild and rebuild it the way it looked before, you will not succeed. And he hammered that point home, and I could tell all the business owners were going, whoa, but we actually took that statement, we put it on a huge poster and we framed it and stuck it in town hall, because he was absolutely right.
Instead of applying uniform solutions to the way we design communities, we need to emphasize a comprehensive and creative process to think outside the box and develop flexible solutions. Solutions that respond to the local context so they can continue to adapt in the face of change.
As community planners, I think if we recognize systems that are stressed or vulnerable and help them reorganize, then we are contributing hugely to the potential of that place. So the key is to recognize when a system is stressed. That would be like a job loss or a conflict or tension between two disparate groups, or, you know, the tornado is an obvious example, but there is change happening in communities all the time. And as that change happens at that creative destruction point, the system will reorganize itself. So it's an opportunity to provide people with the forum that they're longing for in order to think about what they want to do next.
Today, cities and planners face many challenges. Once they have recognized a problem, how can planners and designers bring about the reorganization to shift our cities out of the status quo?
We're going across Ontario to hear stories of people that have done just that, from retrofitting suburbs to sketching new downtown centers on streets with chalk, building a whole new neighborhood in the heart of downtown Toronto, to using geocaching and pop-up bars to engage people in the design of their community. And finally, we'll learn how a declining town, ravaged by a tornado, rebuilt its core and sparked new life. In this episode, we explore community by design. I'm Ross Soward.
And I'm Danielle Davis.
And this is Cities Alive, bringing the city to life with stories. Cities Alive is a planning and design center production. This episode is brought to you by the Ontario Professional Planners Institute.
OPPI is the recognized voice of the province's planning profession. There are more than 4,000 members work in government, private practice, universities, and not-for-profit agencies in the fields of urban and rural development, community design, social services, heritage conservation, housing, economic development, and more. To create great places, planners must go beyond pulling from a formula of planning principles.
When you're talking about planning, there is no beginning. You're always in the middle of something, right? I mean, you're foolish to think that this is the start of something, because if that's the way you're looking at it, in fact, you're ignoring the context of everything that's there already. You are adding to that story of the community.
That's Rob Voigt, a planner, designer, and OPPI member based in Collingwood. He's trying to build a culture of design thinking in Ontario. This means rejecting simple formulas and embracing experimentation to come up with tailored local solutions.
One is the area of specialization dealing with urban design, right? And that really is about the relationship between architecture, landscape architecture, site context, uses, all those things, you know, how they form the public realm, you know, those spaces that we live in. And the other one is really about a design philosophy and, you know, design thinking. Really, it's about iterative change, storytelling, and, you know, learning by doing.
So how do we approach community design usually? These days, there are certain principles that have become synonymous with good community design.
There's a lot of consensus out there in the planning community today about what the principles of good community design are, and they're generally held to be mixed use, mix of housing types, higher densities, connected streetscapes, grid street layouts, open space networks, generally not high-rise design as much as mid-rise, you know, 5-6 stories, that sort of thing. So there's a lot of uniformity that we see in what the planning prescriptions are across North America and to some extent in other parts of the world as well.
Jill Grant is a member of the Canadian Institute of Planners and an academic. Her research takes her across Canada to look at our suburbs and cities and how we can make them better. The layout of suburban communities is often at odds with what planners consider good community design. New development projects in the suburbs present an opportunity to implement community design principles that might not have been considered before.
In the kinds of developments that we see, they play out to different extents in different contexts. Where demand is high, we're seeing more high density, more mixed use with commercial at ground level and residential above, and more transit-oriented development.
Enter Brampton. They seized an opportunity to use federal and provincial funding to create a transit-oriented development in Mount Pleasant. The vision? To create a community that offered a variety of housing and transportation options, centered around a public square with a local school, library, and community center.
Mount Pleasant started with the designation of all the lands in Northwest Brampton as growth by the province of Ontario and the region of Peel back in the 90s, and the decision to open a new GO station in that area, which was late 90s, early 2000. They started work on that with some kind of visioning charrettes and meetings around 2000, 2003. Part of that we clearly identify from the city's part that they should pick up on the opportunity of transit-oriented development. We brought some examples. They even did a tour with their design team, development team, places like Portland, Oregon, and Chicago, and other places, and to see how things work.
The timing of the construction presented an opportunity to think bigger. The federal and provincial money allowed a greater emphasis on the public realm and a higher quality of design. Alex Terenu is a registered professional planner at the City of Brampton.
And the federal funding came as an impetus to be able to A, do amenities from day one. That includes transit, that includes the public amenity, that includes the square, and also do it at a higher level of quality that you would normally be able to do. Then take in account their interest and the city's interest, the fact that other developers such as the school board came, there was an alignment of forces that within very short, 2.5-3 years, managed to build the first phase of this, the most important part, which was the square, the public amenity, and so on.
Mount Pleasant is a pioneering planning project in Ontario and Canada. But sometimes, it's not as simple as having the right plans and funding.
I think that planners, we look to vibrant cities as our models, and we try to sort out what are the principles in those places that we might be able to distill as a formula for good design and vibrant cities. And unfortunately, it's not as easy to conjure up those kinds of places as simply adhering to a formula. So we can put commercial spaces at ground level and residential above, but there's no guarantee that we can fill those commercial spaces at ground level or that the businesses that go into them will succeed over time.
There are things that are beyond the control of even the most well-planned developments. Each project is different, and there's only so much that can carry over from one project to another. Planners must remember how long it can take a community to evolve.
A lot of the commercial that we're putting in at ground is really struggling to survive. And in a lot of places, we see developers struggling to populate those spaces with viable income streams, with businesses that actually produce enough in the way of rent to cover the costs of construction and paying off the interest on the loans that were taken to do that. So, we have this idea, but making it actually work in real communities is really challenging. The kinds of places where we see that commercial grade and residential above are places that have taken that form over time and have built up around a network of uses and residents who populate those businesses patronize those businesses. And so it's really hard for new businesses coming in to achieve that same kind of success.
This is playing out to some extent in Mount Pleasant. One Mount Pleasant shop owner is finding the lack of foot traffic problematic for his business.
This is a business I started because of looking at this bus station and all this thing, and I said the business would be good. Location is good, quite, but city does not implement most of things here. So buses, bus shelters, this bus terminal is there. There are only one bus. There's only one bus. Their plan is to bring all the buses here, so they didn't bring it. And the thing is that because of that, 2-3 business already closed. They started the business, but no traffic, no foot traffic. City is not doing anything much about this. And people are suffering a lot for that. The concept and everything is good, but only thing is that they have to really build this place a nice place. What their plan was there, like live and work and those kind of the businesses should be developed, everything should be developed. But it's not developing. On the other way, it's becoming ghost town.
Projects like Mount Pleasant present a chicken and egg problem. Businesses need to be present to make an area successful and desirable for residents. But the population needs to be there to support the businesses. So what comes first? The struggle of this shop owner highlights the fact that good community design can only do so much to create a vibrant community.
When you get out to the fringe of our cities and you're trying to think about this notion of building complete communities, it's much more challenging to do so. It's much more difficult to figure out what's the right combination or to have things happen in the right kind of sequence. You know, it's for developers, it's always a question of what do you build first? Do you build the housing? And then people are complaining about where's the shops they thought they were going to get? Or do you put in the shops early on and have businesses struggle because there's no business for them to actually make it work? No residents to come and buy what they're selling or whatever.
Yet the answer isn't to not try. The municipality saw an opportunity and seized it. They've pioneered a model for retrofitting the suburbs that we can all learn from.
I think it offers good models in what aspects that there are opportunities, there are go stations, there are transit, there are large commercial sites that could take some of these physical elements, create an open space, have the bus transit there, introduce a grid of streets, have some density, mixed uses and all that. And I think those are all, it's quite challenging because basically the whole conventional suburban development was not meant to change.
Implementing this approach in a suburban context is really challenging.
I know this is what TOD, transit-oriented development, means. I understand it's the combination of transit, car usage, as well as active transportation combined with appropriate land use and mix of uses and density and public space and placemaking, all these nice principles that are easy to read in books, but not so easy to see, and then you realize how it works.
Municipalities can't undertake these types of projects on their own.
I think there are many lessons to be learned, including the fact that I still believe it's almost impossible to do this on your own as a municipality or as a developer.
They need financial and political help from higher levels of government and the right planning framework.
You need also the appropriate planning framework. You need the detail to the community design, to this aspect. You need the block planning to put everything together. Otherwise, just go through regular channels of plans of subdivisions and, you know, infrastructure, typical standards. You need a process to support this kind of innovation. It's still innovation.
Flexibility is also a key consideration for new developments. A big issue with suburban development is the lack of versatility built into the design.
You know, certainly if we look at the kinds of places we were building in the 50s and the kind of places we're building now, we see it's not just our beliefs as planners that have changed that account for why we're setting different rules in place, but the society has changed, what people are looking for has changed, and we can expect that in the future we'll see other changes. So, you know, another 40 or 50 years down the road, people won't be wanting to build the same kind of places we think we want to build today, probably. These things tend to go in cycles and trends change. So we have to provide sufficient flexibility that allow things to adapt. One of my big concerns about the kinds of things we're building today is that we have very little room for flexibility and adaptability in them. The building envelopes are in many places regulated, the land use is regulated, developers are putting covenants and codes restrictions on properties that limit what can happen there. When they're building large-scale developments now, all the houses tend to be built by a small number of builders, so there's a great deal of homogeneity in what we're producing now. We have to, I think, be very cautious about imprinting the rules and regulations with our own expectations about what makes a good city, because it may not be what everybody wants in their city.
Despite the many challenges of retrofitting the suburbs, Mount Pleasant has tried to embrace this idea of versatility.
One of the things that Mount Pleasant does much better than others is other communities, the fact that usually you have one street is the same kind of houses, right? In this instance, you have at the edge of the community, you have singles, then you have semis, then you have a variety of townhouses, you know, back lanes, back to backs, three story, two story, live work, and apartments. And all this offers options. Options, even if, let's say, kids are growing up, they don't want to move out, but they can go on something that's smaller and more livable. Or yourself, you know, one of the owners saying, I don't want to move from my community in 20 years' time, but I can move to buy an apartment and live as empty nester there. Then again, that offers, maybe we can go beyond that. And also the fact that you don't rely on your own property to do everything, you rely on this public realm and you rely on the park. And the fact that everything being tight and cozy also encourages people to interact, to communicate in a much better way.
The development is still very different from the status quo in Brampton. It provides housing and transit options that would not otherwise be available to GTA residents. And it builds momentum for designing communities that prioritize people over cars.
I think this is going to be much easier to retrofit in 20, 30 years' time or to add on. Also because the quality was better than in many other places. Listening is going to be very interesting to follow up and to see to what extent all this physical environment is going to help to create a community which is hopefully more cohesive and more positive than it is in other places in suburban environment, right? The residents' association, maybe the BIA, how things can evolve to get things like, I don't know, farmer's market or, you know, bakery or things like that, really the ultimate sign of urbanity. I'm confident it's going to last well. I'm confident when the trees are going to grow, it's going to look nice, and I hope, you know, to go in my old age and take a look at it and then look at, tell maybe the story again.
The idea of adaptability and versatility is fundamental to Robert's idea about design thinking. He's found that by embracing experimentation, you can inspire community.
If you have this kind of philosophy, I believe, then it allows you to have ongoing dialogue. It allows planners to be involved in the business of building citizens. And by that I mean we are giving them the tools to help influence the world they live in.
In Collingwood, Penetanguishene, and on Yonge Street in Toronto, Rob and his colleagues have incorporated this spirit of experimentation and design thinking, creating dynamic and exciting spaces, and demonstrating the possibilities for this approach.
We've done community meetings, you know, out on site when we were dealing with some park designs. This happened to be a few years back in the town of Collingwood. And so we presented those materials out in the park and talked to people, you know, right where things were happening, right? So people really got a visceral and physical reaction and understanding of the spaces we were talking about because they were standing there. Another one was last summer was in the town of Penetanguishene. We were looking at some road diet work that was going to go on there in kind of a downtown revitalization project that has to happen because of some utility work that needs to happen. And so they have a chance to reimagine their downtown Main Street, you know. And so we were able to do some of those, tactical urbanism kind of pop-up initiatives where we narrowed the lanes, put up some information signage, allowed for those on-street parklets, you know, where people were able to kind of, you know, take over parking space for a patio, you know, with a restaurant or something. And so we use that as a way of testing the main characteristics of this road diet, and we were able to identify that, in fact, hey, the road functions just fine, and in fact, there are all these other livability features that now come into play. We built an outdoor, you know, beautiful nature park right on Yonge Street, right across from the Eaton Center. You know, what was interesting about that, again, in terms of a learning opportunity, is that in the 2 months that that project was underway, we monitored what was happening. And so we saw by this initiative of something that was very outside of people's experience, you know, they'd never seen, you know, these big giant boulders and seating areas made out of big logs and trees and all that in that context. So it'd be very hard to kind of communicate that in a different form, right? I mean, you could show images and all that, and that kind of gets really dreamy in people's minds. It's hard for them to really get a handle on it. But, you know, seeing it out there and experiencing it, in that 2 months, we saw, you know, the businesses getting an increase in foot traffic and actually doing better in their businesses. It managed to calm the street. So now we had cyclists in that part of Yonge Street more than we had before. And people just, you know, sitting and enjoying that little bit of nature and experiencing their environment in a whole different way. So that's one of those ways where you take that idea of learning by doing and these sort of temporal assessments of a project that you're kind of putting in the place where it might have a real home, and learning from that, right? I mean, that's it's a very, very different way than your typical open house.
This approach is inspiring in its ability to blur the lines between engagement and implementation, between planning and action, even shifting the role of the city and stakeholders.
Down in Australia, and they've got this amazing format where it's kind of part meetup, part pop-up bar, talk series, where they really try to have an open forum for engaging citizens, but with more depth than just, you know, asking what would you like to see, but withdrawing the connections where folks might say, you know, this is a vision I have, help me find the resources that you have, you know, that have come here together to help me move that forward, right? And in fact, my wife and I have started doing this now here in Ontario. So we've got kind of the, you know, Idea Bombing Ontario, where we're trying to promote that approach where the workshop leads to, instead of just a series of, a to-do list, projects that need to now go find a home, that there are partnerships already drawn together during that workshop, right? And so these are fun events. You've got live music. You know, we did one up in Huntsville where we had a local musician come out, and it was held at a coffee shop. Again, not your typical town hall meeting, you know, where it's talking heads doing a presentation to the public, but really getting folks to step up and try to work together. So again, you could, you know, we're dealing with design issues, so you can really advance that philosophy in what you're talking about, you know, pretty much limitlessly into any area you want to take it. That's where the planning and community building really gets exciting. So it's about that, you know, a design thinking approach. It's the process can be as important as the outcome, and you're actually designing the process itself. Is how am I going to interact with people? How am I going to get the best input and the best information flow in both directions, so that we can work together, you know, to build a community that serves our needs now and into the future.
How can we scale up these ideas? How can a municipality adopt experimentation and design thinking? And what would happen if they did? In part 2 of this episode, we'll hear stories from cities that are pushing the envelope, one sandbag at a time. and we'll head back to Goderich to find out how the town has used community design to design community. I'm Danielle Davis. Stay tuned.
You've been listening to Cities Alive, the podcast, bringing the city to life with stories. Cities Alive is a Planning and Design Center production. This episode was created and produced by Danielle Davis, Jordy Gordon, Joel Sajunki, and me, Ross Soward. This episode was made possible by support from the Ontario Professional Planners Institute. For more Cities Alive episodes, subscribe to Cities Alive on iTunes or stream Cities Alive at pdcenter.ca. The music in this episode is from Canadian artists who allowed us to use their great songs. Check out Taryn Kawaja, The Rival Boys, Golden Youth, and Sarah Wilkinson if you want to hear more. Remember, there is no beginning. You're always in the middle of something.